From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We've got a great show ahead for you today, and as I've talked about in weeks past, this has been a busy month as far as getting programs out on EWTN television. We've got a number of episodes coming up related to the Explore with the Miracle Hunter travel series. We've got places like Champion, Wisconsin, which will be out in October, and also other places as well around the world. And so we're so excited to be presenting up to, I think, 5 episodes in the next few weeks. And one of the ones I'm most excited about is this new film called Walking with Berega, The Joe Gregorich Story, which airs on September 25th, 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. The story of Joe Gregorich, who dedicated his entire life to the saintly Bishop Berega, known, as you might know, as the Snowshoe Priest of Upper Peninsula, Michigan. And he devoted his life to the study of his life and writings, learning as many as 5 languages in order to translate his letters and push that forward to Rome. And now Bishop Berega is considered a venerable, the second step on that canonization process. So we'll be talking today with Lenora McKean from the Bishop Berega Association about the incredible life of Bishop Berega and the man sort of behind the cause, Joe Gregorich. And later in the show, we'll be talking about one of my favorite saints, perhaps the greatest of all miracle-working saints in modern history anyway, that is the Capuchin friar from San Giovanni Rotondo, that is Padre Pio. And we'll be going there in Italy to explore the life of Padre Pio, again, perhaps the greatest modern miracle-working saint there is, and known around the world for healing miracles by location, and of course, exhibiting the wounds of Christ in the Stigmata. We've got a new episode of the Explore series on September 23rd at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, which is a half-hour program that looks at each of these cities where various miracles have occurred, and we'll be in San Giovanni Rotondo for that one. And so for today's show, we'll be talking with somebody from the National Center for Padre Pio in Bartow, Pennsylvania. We'll be talking about the incredible life and miracles of Padre Pio with his feast day upon us on September 23rd. And of course, later in the show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project like we always do. And for today's date, we've got Our Lady of Hope from Calasparra in Spain in 1786. And the might-be saint of the day is Blessed Joseph Kut. He's from Poland, and he's one of the 108 martyrs of World War II. So we'll be telling a bit about his life. And question of the week, this is a hard one. How do we know that a saint did not spend any time in purgatory? We'll give that one a shot. That's a tough one. Let's take a look at the miracle news. Each week we report on miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And as I often comment in this miracle segment, that there are these softer miracles in which something coincidentally, or a God incidence as some people like to call them, something remarkable that's happened. But I also really like to report on these big miracles like approved Marian apparitions or Eucharistic miracles happening. Well, we have a case that looked like it was potentially a true Eucharistic miracle, at least if you went by social media anyway. So in Argentina, which has been the site of a handful of church-approved Eucharistic miracles, there's been a brand new report that's come out, and the diocese has actually issued a statement about it, about the apparent blood clots that have been appearing on a host. And so on social media, there were various reports from this area in the world, in Argentina, where they said a miracle occurred in the San Vicente de Paul parish in the Villa Tesai. And on August 30th, some hosts had fallen to the floor, and 2 men who are in charge of cleaning the parish informed the priest, and he ordered them to put them in a glass of water until they dissolved, which is the standard practice. Now, the next day, on the 31st, when they're going to clean the parish again and open the tabernacle, or the area where they have that those hosts reserved in water, they looked at the glass, and they could not believe what their eyes saw, and the water had looked a little pink. And at 3 p.m., it began to thicken with a blood clot until 6 p.m., until they stared at a complete miracle. Now, that's what was being reported on social media. And the images that accompanied this were absolutely remarkable. I posted them on the Facebook feed of The Miracle Hunter, and you can connect there each and every day to see the miracles being reported around the world. So this Eucharistic host, or this host anyway, was said to be taken into the custody of the Bishop of Morón. And so when they looked at it, There was a press release on September 4th that said, faced with versions of the story of an alleged Eucharistic miracle that would have occurred on August 31st of this year, the Bishop of Morón, Father Jorge Vasquez, he affirms with the testimony of the priest who celebrated Mass that day that it could in no way be a Eucharistic miracle, since the host to which these texts and audio recordings refer were not consecrated by any priest, but were dropped before being presented in the offertory. And so, and these hosts were kept in a plastic bag and then were put in water to dissolve, as is usual in these cases. However, for everybody's peace of mind, the bishop has already started the corresponding investigation, and the analysis of the said hosts will be carried out in the laboratory, end quote. So that was the English translation from the diocese. So we have a case of something that looks a lot like past Eucharistic miracles, but because it is not a consecrated host, they can say with confidence that it is not a Eucharistic miracle. But what's interesting is that rather than dismiss it, they are going to go ahead with the investigation anyway, and they're going to find out in the laboratory what's going on. So a fascinating case. And again, if you look at the social media post and the image that's been pushed forward with this, and again, you can see that on the Facebook feed of the Miracle Hunter, it looks much like any of the other Eucharistic miracles around the world. So very interesting. And we will follow this one closely. So we'll report back to see if those investigations that the bishop undertakes have any interesting results. But I'm quite sure there'll just be a secondary press release that'll say that we have found a case of red mold or something of this nature. So that's the miracle news for this week. For more information on miracle stories like this one, connect to the Miracle Hunter Facebook page, where there are thousands of followers who want to find out each and every day the miracles and those things that relate to miracles happening all around the world. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week, where we look at the trivia questions related to miracles and other things happening on each show. And so last week we talked about the 3rd century bishop martyr, St. Januarius. Now that was a great interview with church historian Dan Cheely last week about St. Januarius, San Gennaro, that blood that liquefies each and every year on September 19th on the feast day. And for people who want to find out more about St. Januarius, you can watch the television program Explore with the Miracle Hunter Naples, which airs on September 19th at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find out more about that miracle that's said to happen each and every year on the feast day of San Gennaro. And so the question from last week, we talked about St. Januarius, and he was a bishop martyr from the 3rd century. Who was the very first bishop ever to be martyred? And that answer, of course, is St. Peter, the Bishop of Rome. So thank you for those who wrote in with the question. And for this week's show, we're going to be talking about Bishop Berga, who we're hoping and praying becomes a bishop who's canonized in the United States. And so the question is, who is the first bishop in the United States to be canonized? If you think you know the answer to that question, who was the very first priest in the United States, or bishop in the United States to be canonized, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or go through my website, miraclehunter.com. Send me a message, and the first respondent with the correct answer is going to win that prize. Answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the canonization cause of Bishop Frederick Berga. We'll be looking behind the scenes at the new film, Walking with Berga, the Joe Gregory story with Lenora McKean from the Bishop Berga Association. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. This has been a busy month as far as television production goes, and we have a number of films and programs coming out. I think the Explore series, we have in Assisi, we have a San Giovanni Rotondo episode, and also a Naples episode coming out. And next month, Champion Wisconsin, so the Explore series is really exploding. We've got another number of great episodes coming up, and there's a They Might Be Saints episode coming up on October 5th, and that is Francis Xavier Silos, who's a blessed. So I feel very blessed to have this Miracle Hunter month on EWTN television with a bunch of shows coming out. But I have to admit that of all the different programs that are coming out, the program that I'm most excited about is this new program that's been been in the works for a couple years now, and it's called Walking with Berrigan, the Joe Gregorich story. And it's sort of an offshoot or the backstory of the Bishop Berrigan canonization cause. And this is something that that we uncovered years ago when we were preparing for that episode of They Might Be Saints. And that was one of the best episodes we've done, in my opinion, the Bishop Frederick Berrigan episode. And so we sort of uncovered the backstory of how a canonization cause were to come about. Most people don't really know. Most people think that the Pope gets some sort of an idea that, you know, a saint should be made, and then he declares someone a saint. Well, it turns out that there's a ton of effort and money that goes into a saint being made. So normally it's the congregation of a saint, and you'll say, why don't we see more people who aren't priests or nuns who are saints? Well, it's because those congregations or those orders have the money and the impetus, the reason for going ahead and pushing forward those causes to Rome. And oftentimes they take years, decades, centuries sometimes in order to have somebody declared a saint. But in this very rare case, we see the story of Frederick Bishop Berrigan being pushed ahead and all the documentation being collected as the result of the efforts of one man, and his name is Joe Gregorich. So this new film that's coming out is called Walking with Berrigan, the Joe Gregorich story. And so we're so excited today to talk with Lenora McKean. She's the executive director behind the Bishop Berrigan Association, and she's the reason that this program was made in the first place. And we're so excited that we've had the support of Len on this project, and we're so excited that it'll be airing on September 25th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN Television. Welcome back to the show today, Lenora McKean.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Well, it's great to chat with you again, and I'm so excited about this new film that's coming out. Walking with Berrigan is the main title of it, and it's a great way to tell the story of Bishop Berrigan through the eyes and the work of someone else, and that's Joe Gregorich. But before we get too excited and down the path of who was Joe Gregorich, let's really paint the picture for everyone. Who was Bishop Berrigan? Why is he so important in Upper Peninsula, Michigan, and for the United States?
So Bishop Frederick Berrigan was the first bishop of the Diocese of Marquette. He was born in a small village in Slovenia and decided at a very young age as a priest that he wanted to respond to the call for priests to come over and minister to the people that were in this area, which at that time were the Native Americans. And so he spent 38 years ministering to primarily the Native Americans and then the fur traders and the miners when they started coming in throughout the Great Lakes and landing in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which, as if any of your audience knows, is kind of a difficult area, especially in the winter time. So he quickly became known as the snowshoe priest because he was determined to get to the people that he wanted to minister and teach about the faith, regardless of weather, of limitations. And so it was nothing for him to strap on snowshoes and walk 54 miles to get to who he needed to be with. Quite an incredible inspiration for us even today.
Absolutely. And he's somebody who's being recognized by Rome. He's in the middle of the very long and arduous canonization process that has four steps: servant of God, venerable, blessed, and saint. So he's moved on to that second category. And once he has a miracle approved by Rome, which is no small feat, he will be moved on to being blessed. And so how did the canonization cause of Bishop Berrigan get started in the first place? How did the groundswell of support happen that Rome could take notice?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to acknowledge the fact that when he died in 1868, his successor was Bishop Marak, who was also a Slovenian, one of the 17 seminarians that followed Bishop Berrigan over. You know, we have all of the artifacts that Bishop Berrigan used, the tools that he used in his ministry, and he and Father Yacker, they knew what a saintly man Bishop Berrigan was, or they would have disposed of all of those things. So I think from the get-go, people knew that there was something very special about him. But in 1930, they decided to establish the Bishop Berrigan Association, and were really looking for somebody to step up and kind of take hold of the reins, if you will. And Joe Gregorich answered that call. And he spent the next 50 years plus of his life obtaining all the documents, collecting, cataloging them, transcribing them, and translating them. So the material that he obtained came from five different countries. He had to translate them from three different languages, and then actually became the foundation of the positio, or the position paper, that was submitted and accepted by Rome in 1998, proving the heroic virtues of Bishop Berrigan.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. It's the work of many people in reality, but without the work of Joe Gregorich, maybe this canonization cause does not progress or even happen. And when I was there in Upper Peninsula, Michigan, filming in the Diocese of Marquette for the They Might Be Saints episode of Bishop Berger's life, we did an interview with Pauline Gregorich, who is the daughter of Joe. And while her interview didn't make it into that original half-hour special, doing that interview, something really jumped out to me, that this was a remarkable life lived by her father, Joe Gregorich, as far as gathering all the documentation and really pushing that canonization cause forward and making it possible. And that's kind of what led to us putting our heads together and saying, this itself needs to be a new film. And thus the film Walking with Berger, the Joe Gregorich story, has been born. And so why do you think that Joe Gregorich did this, that he spent 50 years or whatever it was, dedicating his life to Bishop Berger? What motivated him to do that?
So Joe's mom was born in Slovenia and attended a parish that of Father Berger's. And she was so inspired and loved Bishop Berger that she taught that to Joe throughout his entire life. And he became very inspired by the tales that his mother told and very interested in Bishop Berger. You know, Joe was a mechanical engineer by trade, and then the Depression hit, and he lost his job and was without work for almost 5 years, which, you know, when we think about that today, that can upset everything that you're working on. And what he did was he threw himself into the research and the documentation of Bishop Berger's life because he knew what a saintly man he was. And while it was difficult on their family regarding the economy in that, it afforded an opportunity for Joe to focus on the research. Pauline will say that she feels like she grew up with a brother. He actually had a bigger bedroom in their house than she did as an only child. But the research was so important that, you know, the microfilm was there at their house, the microfilm reader. She would go with her dad to the library and play under the table while he was doing research. And, you know, her mother, Mary, was very generous, saying, you know, Joe, you need to do this. You know, I'll support you. And later, actually joined him in the office and began membership drives and helping organize the transcriptionists. And but just to let people know the magnitude, he obtained over 600 rolls of microfilm and over 200 feet of printed material that became the Berger Archives collection. Which is just incredible, especially considering the time that he was working in.
Yeah, now what's amazing to me, and this was one of my favorite parts in putting together the episode of Walking with Berger, the Joe Gregorich story, which airs on September 25th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. One of my favorite aspects of this was, you know, it wasn't like the documents that he had to collect were in the building next door or in his basement and he dug them up and he microfilmed them. He had to go to Europe in a very dangerous time in history and uncover some of these documents and microfilm them, bring the microfilm back to the United States so that he could translate these documents. Talk about that a little bit. What was the effort like that Joe had to undergo in order to even get those documents in the first place?
Well, at that time when he went, you know, he was going into what was communist Yugoslavia. And it just by divine intervention, it happened that he was able to do this because of his daughter, Pauline, who, unbeknownst to them, was working on an undercover or very, very secretive mission of the CIA. And she was able to actually help her father get credentials so that he could get to the places he needed to go and have the luxury, really, of the protection of her co-workers. So it really is because of that they were able to obtain the documents. But it reads like a whodunit. It was very cloak and dagger. There were times where Joe would have to give a stranger on the train Pauline's number and say, just call her and let her know I'm okay. And so if you can imagine receiving that phone call as a family member and wanting to know, well, where is he and what's going on, and just receiving that, all I can tell you is he's okay, you know, that would be a little unnerving. But they supported Joe in his endeavor because they knew how important the cause was to Joe, but how important the cause was in general, because they wanted people to know about Bishop Berger. They wanted to know his whole his whole mission was to bring the faith to people, to evangelize and to help them deepen in their faith. And they just wanted to carry that mission on.
Absolutely. I love doing this series, They Might Be Saints, which airs on EWTN Weekly. And everybody who watches kind of has that question of how does it all happen anyways? And this is a great opportunity, this Walking with Berega, to talk about what is the behind the scenes, the backstory of a canonization cause, and one that's a little bit different than the others. And the work of Joe Gregorich is certainly noteworthy, and it sort of set things up for the Bishop Berega Association, which you're the executive director of. How does the Bishop Berega Association continue the work of Joe Gregorich today, moving forward towards Bishop Berega's sainthood?
The mission of the Bishop Berega Association when it was founded was to promote the cause and to educate people about Bishop Berega's life. And so that is what we continue today is we frequently talk that you have to know him as the man, the priest, and the bishop to understand who he was, what he sacrificed to bring the faith, what he did as an advocate for those that he was working with, and the lengths that he would go to teach people and to help them receive the sacraments. And it's amazing to me. I get calls frequently about people who believe that they've received an intercession from Bishop Berega. And I am delighted to say that we do have a potential cure, which is what it's called until it's fully recognized. And it has been completely investigated. It is prepared into a summarium. And it is waiting for the two medical experts to review it in Rome. If one or both of those deem it favorable, it will go on to the medical commission. So we wait. I know people sometimes might get frustrated that I say we wait and we pray, but that's really our job is we wait, we pray, we teach, and we continue to look at how we can draw inspiration and incorporate his zeal for the faith in our own lives.
Wonderful. Well, that's exciting news. I always like talking about miracles in these segments, so you really brought it to the fore with talking about a potential miracle for Bishop Berega. We'll have to pray for that one to be looked at by Rome and later approved, leading to his beatification. We're talking today with Lenora McKean, the executive director of the Bishop Berega Association. Now, coming up in September, around September 25th, is the Berega Days, your annual event where you make the life and work of Bishop Berega known, and you celebrate it sort of to encourage devotion and get people to be praying for his intercession. And Berega Days is coming up, and one of the feature points of this program this year is that the episode Walking with Berega will be shown. What is happening this year during the Berega Days to celebrate Bishop Berega's life?
So this year the event is in Marquette, Michigan. I firmly believe that in order to celebrate somebody, you need to go where they are. And so we have a beautiful Berega Chapel that we built after he was declared venerable. And so it will give people the opportunity to come and venerate the sarcophagus where Bishop Berega is laid to rest. But we also have activities throughout the day. We have reenactments of his life. We have a Native American drum circle that we'll be playing and a teaching because we have a new wood carving that is coming soon that we're so excited to be able to put in the gardens here at the Educational Center. The Educational Center and Museum, which is in the Berega House, and this is really our first year to promote all of it and its completion with its gardens and that, so people will be able to take tours. And then, of course, the dinner and the annual meeting and the release of the new documentary. And I'm just so excited to see all of that.
Yeah, we're so excited. I'm excited to be there myself for this big event, the Berega Days, happening this year in Marquette, Michigan. And of course, the big event for those people who can't make it to Marquette is being able to watch the program Walking with Berega, the Joe Gregorich Story, and that'll be on September 25th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and I'm sure it'll be shown multiple times in the future by EWTN, but that'll be the premiere for people who want to connect with this great program. And going forward, Len, as we keep the focus on Bishop Berega, with the story of Joe Gregorich, Bishop Berega truly is the center of that film. How can we turn to Bishop Berega or use him as a model as we walk with Berega in our world today?
Well, I think he served as a role model. He had a strong devotion to the Blessed Mother, praying the rosary frequently. I can only imagine as he's walking through the woods in the quiet. So perhaps we can unplug and we can spend some time in solitude. He prayed 3 hours a day before he'd start his work, regardless. And there is one mention in his diary where he overslept and he was so upset with himself because Jesus never withheld anything from him, and he just couldn't believe that he had been so careless. So I always tell people, gee, if we could just do 30 minutes a day, what a difference it would make in this world. But, you know, if we could up the ante a little bit, if we could do more, maybe it's attending daily mass. Maybe it is getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to pray. You know, what can you do in your own life to invoke the intercession of Bishop Berica, but also everything is for the glory of God. And that is repeated multiple times in Bishop Berica's letters to his sisters. And he did nothing for notoriety for himself, which could be part of the struggle with the canonization. Perhaps he's saying that, you know, I'm no more holy than all the rest of us are called to. But maybe that's the challenge he's offering us, is to maybe up our game a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, we're so grateful to you, Lenora McKean, the Executive Director of the Bishop Berica Association, for joining us on today's program. And we look forward together for the airing of Walking with Berica on September 25th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much, Len, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael.
God bless. That was Lenora McKean. Always love talking with Len about the life and work of Bishop Berica and her great work there at the Bishop Berica Association. And again, I'm so excited that this is airing on September 25th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. It is called Walking with Berica, the Joe Gregorich Story. It's truly the behind the scenes of a canonization cause, the work of one man to push that forward, Joe Gregorich. And I think you're going to like this one, so check that one out on EWTN. Television. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles, those that are happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love, you know, when I give a talk, I give 20 to 25 talks around the country each and every year. I give a talk for, you know, 45 minutes or so, but then people have questions about miracles. So I try my best to answer them at the end of the talk, and I really enjoy that. But I also get questions into my email inbox at miraclehunter.com. And so here was a good one, and I'm not sure I know the exact answer to this one, but I'll give it my best shot. So the question is, Dear Miracle Hunter, how do we know that a saint did not spend time in purgatory? Thanks, Joe. Well, thanks, Joe, for your question. And it's a good one. You know, I think that when we talk about the Catholic definition of saint, we talk about somebody who's in heaven with God. Well, no commentary is ever made about the path that a person took to get to be in heaven with God. So we all know that there is a heaven, hell, and a purgatory, and there's no set time limit for a person who spends time in purgatory. Theoretically, you could spend a short amount of time or spend centuries in purgatory, depending on your sentence, so to speak. So how do we know that a saint did not spend a short bit of time in purgatory, then advance to heaven, and then intercede for a miracle in heaven, a miracle that's ratified by Rome? Well, we don't really know, actually, but I think that the concept, anyway, is that when the Catholic Church looks at a person's life of virtue, they spend so much time in that positio, that academic position paper is written where they investigate each and every aspect of the person's life, and they turn over every rock, look in every closet, and dig up all the details, all the dirt on a saint's life, potential saint's life. And it isn't until everything passes muster that the Catholic Church will actually approve them as a venerable. And then at that point, and only at that point, can miracles be looked at for their intercession, where they become blesseds and then saints. So theoretically, it is possible that a person who is spent some time as a holy soul of purgatory, holy soul is a saint in the making, so to speak. Everybody who makes it into purgatory will be in heaven someday and will therefore be a lowercase s saint. But how do we know that the capital S saints didn't spend a moment in purgatory? We don't really know, but the implication anyway is that the Church has spent so much time vetting their life of virtue, and when a miracle is allowed through the intercession through Rome, the heaven is sort of vetting that process or validating that the person is in heaven with God. So that's as far as we can go with knowing the answer to that question. So thank you, Joe, for your question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and send me a message that way. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day. We all know Fatima, May 13th, or Guadalupe, December 12th, or Lourdes, February 11th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion that lines up exactly to each day in the calendar year. And so we have those big ones, of course, those major miracle stories, but we also have smaller ones like Our Lady of Hope from Calasparra in Spain in 1786, which is today's devotion. So the story goes that when a shepherd found an image inside a cave, authorities arranged to transfer it to one of the churches of the town. Miraculously, it became so heavy that it was thought to be a sign, so they did not move it. And the miraculous nature of the image is acknowledged to this day, with hundreds of devotees lining the walls of the chamber attached to the chapel of the Virgin. And Our Lady of Hope is the official patron of Calasparra since 1840, and the canonical coronation of the patron is held on September 8th, 1996. And festivities in her honor mainly focus on the celebration of a mass and pilgrimage on September 7th, the Feast of the Virgin. And also on September 18th, another celebration is held. An annual transfer of the patron saint to Calasparra takes place on the first Sunday in May. And that's today's feast day, Our Lady of Hope from Calasparra in Spain in 1786. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, connect to the page of 365dayswithmary.com, or you can pick up the book, or you can download the app 365 Days with Mary from the App Store, or you connect to the Facebook feed with over 10,000 followers, people who want to find out the Marian devotion for each and every day. Let's check out the Might Be Saint of the Day segment. We do this every week where we look at the news related to those who might be saints. And when we're talking about those who might be saints, we're talking about servant of God, venerable, blessed, those steps in the canonization process before they become saints. And this connects to my television show on EWTN called They Might Be Saints. And that's on Mondays at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time and Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information on this series, you can go to theymightbesaints.com. And so when we look at the news, there's been a lot of sainthood news this past week or so. You can connect to the Facebook feed of They Might Be Saints, and you can see all the stuff posted there. But we had an article where Pope Francis is excited about a future saint because he's from Argentina. So Pope Francis joyfully shared the news of the beatification of Mamerto Equiu, who is the Bishop of Cordoba, Argentina. At the end of the Angelus on September 5th, Pope Francis greeted the beatification of Mamerto Equiu, the friar minor and Bishop of Cordoba in Argentina, which was celebrated in Catamarca on September 4th. In his quote celebrating this beatification the day before was, "Finally, an Argentine blessed," he exclaimed with joy. And so the Holy Father described the new blessed as a, quote, "zealous herald of the word of God for the building up of the ecclesial and civil community," end quote. And he prayed that his example would help to, quote, "always unite prayer and apostolate and to serve the causes of peace and fraternity," end quote. And he invited the crowd to applaud the new blessed. And so throughout history, there have been very few saints and blesseds throughout the history of Argentina. And so this excitement by Pope Francis is explained by the fact that Argentina, which is a huge Catholic country, paradoxically has only very few saints and blesseds. And there are only two Argentine saints, Hector Valdivielso Sales and Saint Jose Gabriel de Rosario Brochero. And 10 Argentines have been beatified in addition to those two saints. And so this Mamerto Equiu, he was born in Argentina in 1826. He became a member of the Order of the Friars Minor Franciscans in 1842, ordained in 1848. And he felt called to the missions and left for Bolivia and teaching assignment in the seminary there. And Pope Leo XIII noticed his work and made him Bishop of Cordoba in 1880. So great life of charity and prayer there by a future saint, and we have an Argentine blessed, Marmerto Equiu, the Bishop of Cordoba, somebody that Pope Francis is pretty excited about. Now let's take a look at the might-be saint of the day. We do this every week, where we talk about somebody on that path to sainthood who might be a saint, who lines up exactly to the day's date. So for today, September 18th, we've got Blessed Joseph Coote, and he is one of the 108 martyrs of World War II, and he was born on January 25th in 1905 in Poland. And the he was a parish priest in the Archdiocese of Poznan, Poland, and he was arrested in October by the Gestapo during the Nazi occupation of Poland. He was imprisoned and tortured in Dachau concentration camp, and through the intervention of some influential friends, Father Joseph was offered release if he would just renounce his priesthood. But he refused to do this, and he was killed. And he is a martyr. He died on September 18th, 1942, in the Dachau concentration camp in Germany. He died of starvation, disease, abuse, and neglect. And he was beatified on June 13th, 1999, by his countryman, Pope John Paul II. And that's Blessed Joseph Coote, the might-be saint of the day for September 18th. For more information on him and any of the other might-be saints, check out theymightbesaints.com for more information on that. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Nick Salkowski, the Director of Communications from the National Center for Padre Pio, about that incredible miracle-working saint. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who know me know I love talking about the saints and I love talking about miracles. And I get this question a lot. Who is the greatest miracle-working saint? Who should people pray to if they're looking for a miracle? And I don't really have that answer. Each and every person has their own individual reasons for connecting with saints, and different saints respond in different ways to different people. But in my opinion, the greatest miracle-working saint, in the modern era anyway, is Padre Pio. His life of sanctity is amazing, and the miracles which surround his life are absolutely incredible. And we've actually got a new program coming out on EWTN television dedicated to the life of Padre Pio, and that's called Explore with the Miracle Hunter San Giovanni Rotondo. And so San Giovanni Rotondo, of course, is the place where Padre Pio lived, most famously. And so I travel around the world and I do these half-hour episodes from places around the world. We've done Lourdes and Lanciano with the First Eucharistic Miracle and Pere Le Monial, the place of the Sacred Heart. But we're turning to San Giovanni Rotondo on September 23rd at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time to look at the life of Padre Pio. And this is somewhat of an offshoot of a previous project I worked on called The Miracles of Padre Pio, which, to my knowledge, was the most popular of all the programs I've done so far. Tons of people around the world love Padre Pio, and they love hearing about his miracles. And in that program, we actually featured the National Center for Padre Pio, because they promote the work of Padre Pio here in the United States. And we're so excited today to be joined again by Nicholas Salkowski. He's the Director of Communications for the National Center for Padre Pio. Welcome back to the show today, Nick.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to talk with you again, and I always love talking about these miracles of Padre Pio, and I think it's a remarkable thing when we talk about the various phenomena that were associated with him. And I think that, you know, there are some major categories of things where we talk about his stigmata, for example. So these are bearing the wounds of Christ for 50 years. That is something that is the most remarkable case in the modern era. So what do we know about the stigmata, for example, of Padre Pio?
Well, we know that he received all five wounds of Christ physically, the ones that you could see, of course, both hands, both feet, the side. One of the wounds that really goes untalked about, something that not a lot of people know, when Padre Pio would be asked which, of course, was the most painful wound, he would answer that it was the wound of his left shoulder. Padre Pio was given the gift of not only the visible wounds of Christ crucified, He was also given the gift of being able to feel the weight of the cross upon his shoulder. I think that that's really interesting. It's something that not a lot of people know.
Absolutely. And I know there at the National Center for Padre Pio, you have some of the blood-soaked gloves of Padre Pio and other information and signs related to his stigmata. And we talk about other interesting phenomena with Padre Pio. We talk about his penchant for bilocation, or at least the claims of bilocation, where he was said to be in two places at once. Is there anything to this rumor or legend or idea that Padre Pio could have been in two places at one time?
Certainly, not only while he was alive, but after death. There's one miracle that occurred in the late 1980s after Padre Pio the early 1980s, after Padre Pio had been deceased for almost 15 years at that point. I believe you're familiar with this, the miracle that happened right here in Pennsylvania, Paul Walsh, where he appeared in his mm-hmm. hospital room after death. Paul recounted seeing this man appear in his hospital room, didn't know who he was at first until his mother showed him a prayer card the next day after his miraculous healing. Padre Pio was known to be at various other churches that pertained to some of the other saints that he had devotion to. While he was alive, he could be seen at his own friary by people, and then reports of him being in other locations at the same time. So there's certainly a great amount of evidence that he was able to do this.
Absolutely. And he's also known for, of course, healing miracles. People would come in droves in order to receive a blessing by Padre Pio while he was alive. And even the story, you know, we have in this episode of Miracles of Padre Pio, the story of Vera Calandra, who is the daughter of the foundress of your National Center for Padre Pio. Perhaps talk about that miracle or any of the other miracles that are associated with Padre Pio and his healing miracles.
Well, of course, that is the one that we here at the center are most familiar with. In 1966, Vera Marie Calandra was born to her family. She was the fifth of six children. She was born with congenital defects of the urinary tract. Of course, she was not given very long to live. Her parents turned to prayer after the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia said that there really wasn't much that they could do other than to keep her comfortable. Vera, the elder Vera, experienced what she would call a distinct locution. Padre Pio spoke to her while she was in her home in Narstown. She heard his voice, "Bring your little girl to me here in Italy. Do not delay. Come immediately." So she did. She explained to her husband why she needed to do this. Her husband gave her his support, his blessing. She took little Vera Marie along with their one-month-old daughter to San Giovanni Rotondo. She was granted two audiences with Padre Pio. The first one did not go the way that she had hoped. Of course, Padre Pio barely looked at them. Vera was really not too happy about that. She was angry. She felt as though she had made this trip. She had spent all this money. She took her children overseas. She did not speak the language. She was not familiar with the terrain. She did all of this on faith, and she was disappointed that Padre Pio did not give her very much of his time. She went back the next day. She was able to attend his morning Mass, and she was granted permission to wait in the hallway for him after Mass, and she had a lot that she wanted to get off her chest. When Padre Pio was wheeled past her, of course, he was in a wheelchair at this time, this time around, their eyes met. They connected through their hearts. She would go on to later recount that she wasn't sure why she was asking for what she found herself asking for. Instead of asking for the healing of her child, she was asking for a miracle so that the people of the world would believe. When they returned to America, she brought Vera Marie back to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she was examined. And they found that she had experienced a miraculous healing. The bladder that had been removed from Vera Marie before their trip began to regrow, they discovered upon the return from Italy.
Now that's something that doesn't happen. That's not a thing, regrowing of a bladder. I mean, that is a remarkable miracle.
Organs do not regrow. So the Surgeon General, or C. Everett Koop, was Vera Marie's surgeon at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He would go on to become Surgeon General of the United States. And he wrote extensively about this. I mean, this was just something that there was, of course, no explanation for. organs do not just regrow.
That is truly amazing. And when we talk about Vera Calandra, the mother of Vera Marie, having received this miracle of her daughter, this impelled her to spread far and wide the message of Padre Pio. What happened next as far as this leading to the building of the National Center for Padre Pio?
So Padre Pio died about 3 weeks after the Calandras visited with him. In spring of 1969, Vera would take her family back to San Giovanni Rotondo to the tomb of Padre Pio to thank him for this grace that she received. And she also was sure that she was going to keep her promise to him. She was going to make sure the world knew of Padre Pio, of his love for our Lord, of the greatness of his life. She would go on to speak to the friars in San Giovanni. She told them of her intentions, and they were supportive of her. From her kitchen table in Narstown, she began to spread this devotion to him. She started a prayer group for Padre Pio in her own church that began to grow. On the first Saturday of every month, they would meet, and the church would be full. She began receiving letters from all over the world. She would answer at her kitchen table, and she decided to start this organization, the National Center for Padre Pio, and it started right in her kitchen, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. The family purchased a piece of land in Bartow, Pennsylvania, an old barn, farmhouse with a barn. The center would become known as the barn. They became anonymous. People would call, they would refer to the center just simply by the barn, and everybody knew what they were talking about. The offices were in the barn. They were able to convert a portion of the barn to a chapel and a gift shop, and people would come from far and wide to see. Vera would speak throughout the world. She was invited to countless universities, churches, monasteries, all over the world to speak, and she became very well known to Padre Pio's devotees throughout the world.
Yeah, that's amazing. We're talking today with Nick Salkowski from the National Center for Padre Pio about the origins of the National Center for Padre Pio, the miraculous backstory. And how does this carry on even to today, the National Center for Padre Pio? How can people, pilgrims and otherwise, learn about the work of Vera Calandra and what is available there at the shrine today?
So the facility that we're in now is a destination for pilgrims still from all over the world. People can come and see the replica chapel that we have here of Our Lady of Grace Capuchin Friary from when Padre Pio was alive. We also have a museum and cultural center where people can come and learn about the life and spirituality of Padre Pio. You mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that we have some gloves and various other relics of Padre Pio. We have the largest collection of Padre Pio relics outside of San Giovanni Rotondo. People can come and see. We give tours of the museum. Our museum contains different aspects and also stations throughout Padre Pio's life. For instance, you can come and see what his farmhouse in Pietrelcina looked like, and you can go through his life step by step all the way to his cell at Our Lady of Grace Capuchin Friary, and finally his tomb, where we have replicated his tomb area, the first one, not the one that exists currently. And we do get various people who come, and they're here, and they're looking for healings, and they're looking for help from Padre Pio. You started the conversation by talking about all of these people who express that when they really need something, Padre Pio is the one that they turn to, and we see a lot of that here as well.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Nick Salkowski, Director of Communications from the National Center for Padre Pio in Bartow, Pennsylvania. And there are so many miracles that are recounted there at the National Center for Padre Pio, even people who have come there to pray for Padre Pio's intercession. I know you've got various miracle stories there. For people who want to find out more about visiting the National Center for Padre Pio, what's the best way that they can connect with the center there?
The easiest way is to go right online. They can visit our website. It's www.padrepio.org. And right from the website, there are links to our Facebook page, our YouTube channel. We stream live every day our Rosary, Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Right now, we are in the midst of our Novena to St. Pio, our 9-day Novena from the 14th through the 22nd of September, leading up to his feast day on September 23rd. We are open for pilgrims. It has been a very difficult time for everyone through the pandemic, but we are here. We are waiting for the people to come and see us, and we hope that as many people will join us over the course of the next week or so as possible.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Nicholas Okowski, the Director of Communications for the National Center for Padre Pio, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. We appreciate it, and do it again soon.
God bless. That was Nick Zolkowski talking to us about the life and work of that incredible miracle-working saint, Padre Pio. Check out PadrePio.org for more information about the National Center for Padre Pio and for making your own visit there in Bartow, Pennsylvania. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives and look for Miracle Hunter, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank Nick Zolkowski from the National Center for Padre Pio in Bartow, Pennsylvania, for joining us. And, of course, I mentioned that coming up on September 23rd, the feast day of Padre Pio, at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time, there's an episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter, San Giovanni Rotondo, that'll be airing for the first time, so check that one out. And we're also grateful to talk with Lenora McKean, who is the Executive Director of the Bishop Berga Association. And on September 25th at 8:30 a.m. Central Time, we'll be having a new program called Walking with Berga, the Joe Gregorich Story. I'm excited about that one, so check that one out as well. And for somebody who wants something to watch even before those two air, St. January, September 19th, we've got the Explore with the Miracle Hunter in Naples coming up at 1:30 p.m. Central Time. And sign up for the newsletter on MiracleHunter.com for more information on miracle stories, where I'll be speaking next, upcoming book releases, and more. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.